It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis and Stacey Higginbotham are here. Ron Amadio joins us from Ars Technica. He'll talk about his story. I love Leaving the Nest, about Tony Fadella and Nest and the terrible situation there at Google. We'll also take a look at Google's machine learning and Watson. Watson's got a recipe he wants to cook for you. It's weird. It's all next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 356, recorded Wednesday, June 8th, 2016. No woe, slow, or go. This Week in Google is brought to you by Varidesk. Varidesk easily converts your existing desk or cubicle into a standing desk, so you can switch between sitting and standing to stay fit and active at work. Learn more at Varidesk.com. That's V-A-R-I-Desk.com. And by Atlassian. Unleash your team's potential with collaborative software tools like HipChat and Jira, which will enable you to work and communicate better together. Visit Atlassian.com to learn more. And by Texture, the mobile app that lets you access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. For your free trial, visit texture.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. And we've got a googly group together to talk about Google, Facebook, Twitter, the Twitterverse, journalism, what's wrong with the world. Jeff Jarvis is an expert in all of the above, from BuzzMachine.com and CUNY and the CUNY School of Journalism, where he is a professor. Nice to see you, Jeff.
Good to see you.
Back home. You flew home early just for this. Thank you.
Yes. I was supposed to be on a noon flight, and I got on an 8 a.m. flight out of Heathrow. It's okay. It's okay. I'm neurotic and get to airports wildly early.
You know, at Heathrow, the sooner you get there, the better. You should get there the day before.
Yeah. Actually, Terminal 2 with United is nice now.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Sorry. Well, yeah, it's
the rest of it's
Heathrow is only a nightmare if you have to transit, like if you have to go from one airline to another. Everybody agrees.
And I've got a bad foot right now, and the walking, the distances you have to walk are ungodly, but fine, I'm home.
Okay, we're here. No more problems. Stacey Higginbotham is also here. Great to have you. From Stacey on IoT, our new star. Love having you on. And look who else we brought just for you, Ron Amadio from Ars Technica. Great to have you, too.
Always good to have you, Ron. Always.
Always fun to be here.
Did you have a good Google I.O., Ron? We haven't talked to you since.
Oh, yeah. It was awesome. Google I.O. is always like the most fun thing ever. I'd have I.O. every week if they left it up to me.
This was an interesting I.O. because on the surface, it looked like it wasn't really, you know, it was just a lot of Me Too products, like catch-up products. But I felt like, and I think we talked about this last week, it really was almost a sea change for Google, almost kind of a course correction to move into machine learning and smart bots and things like that, smart assistants. You agree or disagree? What did you think of it?
They've been pushing the machine learning thing for a while, I think. So I thought that was just kind of a continuation. I did think it was interesting that they moved into smart home stuff. Like, I'm super pumped about Google Home just because I love the Echo, but it's really kind of dumb. Like, you can't get it to answer a lot of questions or anything. But for me, the most fun is always just roaming this year it was roaming the parking lot, but, you know, just wandering around and saying hi to people and meeting everyone and doing demos and stuff. It's always fun.
I feel, I can't remember if we talked about this last week. We had Kevin Kelly on. Actually, his interview on Triangulation airs Monday, right before our WWDC coverage. We taped it last week. I don't think we talked about it because I think it, but one of the things he was talking about is machine learning / artificial intelligence. And he said, just as when you had electrification, everybody looked at what they were already doing and added electricity to it. A farmer would take a pump and say, you know, that'd work a lot better if it were electric. And similarly, the internet, we applied a thin layer of internet to everything from travel to hotels, and it changed everything, and it spurred a whole era of innovation. He says that's the next thing, is applying a thin layer of machine learning to everything. And that's kind of what Google Home is, and Echo, and is putting some machine learning on these devices makes them a heck of a lot more useful, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Google has a big list of stuff now that does machine learning. I think it's like the Google Photos search does all sorts of crazy machine vision stuff. Inbox has smart replies where it will kind of type most of the message for you. That's all machine learning. They're doing, you know, their crazy Go thing, which they're going to take on. They did beat the fourth best Go player. Now they're going to try to beat the best Go player in the world. So it's going to be the Go Super Bowl. I'm super excited for that. I hope they bring back the same announcers as last time, because that was
they were great, weren't they? I loved watching them. Yeah. But do you agree, Stacey, I think this is where innovation happens, is you take existing stuff and you add, in this case, intelligence to it. Look at your car.
Yes. And you could look at everything. And I think with what Google was talking about is they started putting the story around it. They've been investing in machine learning for
forever,
years.
Yeah.
And the stuff that people are trying to do with this is freaking amazing. But we also talk about it like it's better than it actually is. So if people don't actually understand what's happening, they're like, we get all the conversations about machines taking over the world, killing off the human race. Right. But we also have these crazy outsized expectations for what it's going to do. And we're so not there yet.
Well, just as in 1995, the internet coating you applied to the thin candy shell coating you applied to magazines wasn't so hot.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But we've come a long way. Go ahead, Jeff. Stacey. No, I'll let Jeff go and then we'll go back to Stacey.
No, I think the big thing that I see is that in a machine learning world, in a conversational world where it can anticipate your questions, get you answers, it disambiguates media so much more. Yeah. There's no need to go to a destination. There's no need to go to a place to get something. If the machine can get it for you and can anticipate your needs and bring it to you, which is great. It'll be wonderful. But where do we put ourselves, support our brands and all that? Very unknown.
And that's what people are struggling with, isn't it?
Oh, you bet.
I think there's like Google Now, which is not the smartest thing, but it is smart. That offers me websites that I visit a lot. It offers me the topics I'm interested in, like Kim Kardashian. I keep trying not to click on it, but when it shows it to me, but it's figured that out, and it actually figures out the places I go the most. So in a way, it helps me stay in touch with brands that I might kind of forget about. So that's the kind of positive side. I was going to say, though, what we don't know yet is the big shift in monetization, the big economic shift that's going to come from AI. So if you think about the internet as a distribution model and what that did there, and then the way that that was kind of monetized, I'm very curious to see what changes with AI.
Well, monetization is a big topic right now because of ad blockers. I'm seeing more and more sites not let me in. And I just saw a story that the New York Times is about to block the blockers and say you can't read the content on the New York Times if you've got an ad blocker running. This is a very interesting times. We're struggling. These guys are really struggling.
But the thing, you know, I have a post up later in the run, and I was at three conferences in Europe this last week, and at one of them, Three, which is a carrier in the UK, is going to cut all ads for one day on mobile.
Oh man.
And much fear about this, much trepidation, obviously.
Oh, man.
And there are those that say, let's get all these big players together, let's pull a Taylor Swift on them, and let's all boycott them. And somebody stood up in the room and said, do we really want to be in the position of standing with the advertisers against our users? Our users are using the ad blockers because they're pissed at us. We got to deal with that fact. And I think it's just simply true. We have to reinvent, as I said on the show before, we have to reinvent advertising, rethink what it is, rethink where the value is. Just irritating people with messages is not going to work. The thing that struck me from this tour is how much everybody is now agreeing that the reach business model, just volume for volume's sake, is gone. It's dead. We killed it.
You were, this trip was three different publisher summits in Europe.
Yeah, one was the Springer Distributed Content Summit in Berlin. I talked to you the night before that, last show. And then I went to Newsgeist, the European version, in Bilbao, which was fascinating.
That's a Google event.
By Google, right? Google brings together about 150 news people. And then I went to Google News Publishers Day run by Google Play. Full disclosure, I take no money from Google as a fee. Google and Springer did pay for much of my travel over, so you know. And so it was fascinating. We can talk about this more later, but it was fascinating to see, for me, just that to Stacey's point, there's a recognition happening that we cannot save the old business models. And what comes next, how we do it is, you know, they're dying for subscription. I don't think that's going to do it entirely either. But the idea of just getting more and more ads and throwing more crap in people's eyes, that's not a winner.
I'd hate to be in that position. Of trying to solve this, because people aren't going to pay.
No.
The risk the New York Times and everybody else is running, and I'm seeing it more and more, is you put up that banner that says, either pay us or turn off your blocker, I turn around and leave.
Yep.
That's a risk.
I'm working with The Guardian on membership, which is a model that I do believe in. I think people will pay, but they'll pay for different motives. They may pay as a patron. When people pay NPR, they don't pay for access to content. They pay because they believe the country needs it. I pay the New York Times, and they won't listen to me on this. I don't pay them for access to content. I pay them because the New York Times is important.
Right.
But then don't abuse me in return. You know, and then that's the issue. I'm not saying the New York Times ads are bad. They're far better than other sites. Part of the problem. Go ahead, Stacey.
Oh, this is kind of part of that patronage model or membership model. The Information, which is a Silicon Valley kind of publication, after Tony Fadell on Friday said he was leaving Nest, they actually, within an hour of the news being out, pushed a subscriber conference call to have their reporters online talking about what this meant. Wow. Which I thought that
was very interesting. I didn't join it. I meant to. I didn't get around to it. Did you join it?
I did not join it.
I'm a subscriber.
It was late on a Friday.
But that was the problem.
But that's why that happened late on a Friday. Anyway, right. That ties to your membership model, Jeff.
Because paid content isn't just here's our page of what we always made. You get it. Paid content is things like events, buying a book, buying a ticket. That's paid content too, and I'm all for that. I think that works. But just the idea that you should suddenly pay for what you can get. We're a commodity business. Information is a commodity, and just because I think my prose is so brilliant and wonderful and special when I impart the same information somebody else imparts doesn't mean you should pay me for it.
I'm sympathetic. If people blocked our ads, we'd have no way to monetize, and I couldn't keep doing this. Period. I mean,
But your ads are not irritating. Some do, but not enough do.
Yeah.
If you suddenly decided, and this is why you're very careful about this, I quoted you in Europe. Because I've had this crazy idea that we should do our own ad blocker as publishers. What that really means is just simply we have our own standards. And you do that. You have your own ad blocker. You pre-block ads.
Yeah, we do. Right? That's a good point.
Again and again, right? Lisa says again and again how you turn away more ads than you take. And that's really important because it's exactly what you're doing. You're the pre-blocker.
I mentioned that at the IAB, the Interactive Advertising Bureau, upfronts in New York City a couple of months ago, and there was an audible gasp from the advertisers in the audience, because I think that's kind of unheard of. Nobody turns down money and says, "Well, no." But it's a long term investment, right? Because I don't if I crap this thing up with ads, I wish that the other publishers had turned down the belly fat ads, right? We wouldn't have to use ad blockers.
Exactly. So there are two things on this. One is I talked to a publisher who was laughing, and he said, you know, the secret that nobody wants to say, I never thought of this before, was that a lot of the reason for ad blockers is probably not because of the ads that we have. It's probably because they want to get rid of them on porn sites, and it takes off every other ad there is.
You know, that's the problem with ad blockers. It does it everywhere.
Yeah, sorry, Stacey. Gina could have warned you. We somehow end up with sex.
Daring Fireball, John Gruber has one very minor, completely unobtrusive ad, but that gets blocked along with everything else by ad blockers.
Exactly.
And that's why Marco Arment got stopped. He was doing an ad blocker for iPhone. He decided to get out of that business because he realized it was blocking ads that were tolerable. But then you do things like AdBlock Plus does, which you have the acceptable ads policy.
Oh, but that's pure blackmail.
But that's what, and then you get accused of.
Shady.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's awful.
But what awful. What they say, and that we interviewed them, they say, well, no. Well, look, we okay. Two things, and maybe they shouldn't mix the two. We think that there are some ads that are fine, and if we have a standard for acceptable ads, we shouldn't block them. That means that people with unobtrusive, not bad ads, ads that don't have flash, ads that don't give you malware, should be allowed through. The problem is they ask those companies for money, and they say, well, we got to pay for this service that we're providing, so that's how we monetize it. And that's where you get that.
It's clearly a moral hazard. It's extortion. But you do see the biggest,
they say, no, it's not extortion because it has to be an acceptable ad. We set the standard.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Well, but fact, that they take money makes it extortion. I mean, if they
looks
had
like
just
it.
Said, if they had just said, let's make an alliance of like good ads that treat users respectfully, I think that would be one thing. But that they block your ads and then come to you as a publisher and say, hey, give us money now.
That sounds like extortion.
So that we'll stop taking money away from you is really bad, and gets them very hostile reactions from websites.
Newsgeist, and this is Chatham House rules. So I won't say who said it to whom, but well, it's to whom is going to be obvious. An editor there, a top editor there, went after Google pretty strongly, saying, if these things are evil, what are you doing, Google, paying for the whitelist? You should be leading the
way.
They
do. They pay for acceptable ads, yeah.
And it was a very funny moment because the PR guy in the room was kind of like, well, that's
not my choice. That's somebody else at Google, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Google's got a response. They're doing AMP. This is Google's response. And this is where I've always, to me, I've also had issues with this. AMP is Google's way of responding to the burden that ad tech ads, and I think ultimately it is an ad standard. In fact, they're now, as you can see, bringing new ad types, including some pretty annoying ads. What they call the flying carpet ads. What, you know, the ones, that's this. Uh-huh. See that over in the right here where you're trying to read something as you scroll. You scroll through the ad, and then this advertisement is scrolled up, and it says, keep on scrolling to read more.
So this is the problem. When they pay sops to the publishing industry, I just wrote a big post.
So why is Google any better than Adblock Plus?
Well, what else do you want to see? This is something that I think it's worth, instead of just complaining about this, we should talk about, well, what's a good ad? What does that
precisely
look like for people?
Precisely, Stacey.
Well, I think
we
that's
need
what
to set the standards.
So... okay, let's see. Let me read the acceptable ads policy and see if we would agree. On the one hand, I kind of feel like these guys are getting a bad rap. That I think they are, Adblock Plus is trying to. They probably shouldn't combine it to money, but
no, they should. It's a moral hazard. Period. Period. Right. You're right, Stacey. There should be a jury, a council of the public.
Isn't there an advertisement group?
IAB.
IAB, thank you. I was like, God, what is it?
So here's the acceptable ads. Ads are acceptable if they do not disrupt the user's natural reading flow, like a flying carpet ad. Okay, they have to be placed on top.
That ad definitely disrupted my reading
flow. Yeah, so that would not be considered an acceptable ad, whether you paid them money or not. Ads should always be recognizable as ads. They shouldn't be mixed in with content in such a way that they look like the content. They have size limitations.
Hold on, Leo. Right there. That's in the moral hazard category. That's because they don't want native advertising, because ad blockers don't know how to block native advertising.
Well, come on. This is Google allows Taboola and Outbrain, which would not be allowed in acceptable ads.
That was another
ads.
Big discussion.
Those are the. If you like this, you'd like to see more of this. And they are not. They don't say advertisement. They are not distinguishable.
Oh, I absolutely agree. They send you to utter clickbait junk.
Do you not? So far, this acceptable ads policy is more rigorous than Google's own AMP policy.
Neither is independent. And Stacey's point is exactly right. What you need is some kind of independent body that represents the public that says, we know you have to make money. We know you're going to have ads. Okay. Here is the definition of quality, and here is the definition of irritation. And that only comes if there's some measure of independence.
Yeah, I think also it needs to be somebody that understands the realities of journalists needing to get paid. So, you know, yes. you could Amen. Make a list, which I don't know if Adblock did this, but you could like make a list of requirements, and publishers might look at that and say, yeah, there's no way we could operate with ads like this because we wouldn't earn enough money. Like, where is the this is acceptable to users, but is it acceptable to publishers in that they will make enough money to continue operating?
And everyone has to abide by them, because this is something I'm discovering is I get so many requests for like sponsored content or native ads on my site, which is, you know, relatively small and niche, but I don't do it because it's not what I want to, I don't want to confuse my users. And it's very frustrating because enough other people do it. They're like, I'm willing to have you use your name to byline something on my stuff, but I'm not willing to, you know, advertise against your reporting. And I'm just going to take my money elsewhere, which that's their business. That's fine. But the fact that there's plenty of even relatively decent brand names willing to do native advertising is detrimental to journalists who are trying to actually do what I think of as journalism.
Yeah. I think there's a conflict of interest with this acceptable ads, then there's a conflict of interest with Google's suggested AMP.
I agree.
Google's an ad company saying, well, we'll do it this way.
That's why AMP is an open standard. Then it needs to be governed by an open standards body.
That's what I've always said, and it's not.
It's early days.
It could become one.
It could and must become one. Otherwise, it will lose that credibility.
To AdBlock's Plus credit, acceptable ads is a policy not just AdBlock's Plus. Many other ad blockers adhere to this policy as well.
What do you guys think about different ads on mobile versus the web? I know it's hard to, but I mean, because there's some things I'll tolerate on the web that I'm just like.
Well, that magic carpet doesn't even make sense on the web. It only makes sense in a mobile space where you're scrolling with your finger in a limited column. So there are clearly ads that are targeted at mobile that don't show up on your desktop. So there must be a way to, you know, there is a way to distinguish the two. I think that's not a bad idea. I think you make an excellent point. Certainly they say, for instance, the size of the ad depends on the size of the page. So, you know, it's got to be a percent, not a pixel number, right?
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. What were some of the other criteria? Did you go through more?
Yeah, I think text ads with excessive use of colors and are elements to grab attention, not permitted. Static images are fine. But they don't allow flash ads. For ads and lists and feeds, like a podcast feed, there are restrictions. Search ads, there are restrictions. I understand the potential conflict of interest here. On the other hand, I like these acceptable ad standards.
So here's what should happen. What AdBlock Plus should do, what Google should do, is the same. They need to push into a true open source project, the fundamental underlying work. If you want to make money on top of that in some way,
they do.
Then you can, but they're not.
They do. No. The acceptable ads database is used by other blockers freely.
But who sets the standards?
There's no reason.
That's
to
the
pay
problem. No. Moral hazards.
No. They say by an independent committee.
Who?
Let me see here. They had 20 leading publishers, tech companies, journalists, advertisers, nonprofits, and academics. They're formulating an acceptable ads committee, which will take over the initiative sometime next year. This was This was 11/2015. I think I understand why people assume that this is a conflict of interest and is shady. I'm not convinced it is. After talking to these guys, I felt like they were trying to do the best that they could. And I think an ad blocking company. And by the way, you can use their ad blocker and turn it off so that you don't see any ads acceptable or not.
How expensive is it to run this? Then run something much cheaper, get a grant from some foundation, which they could do, and make it a truly open, decent project. BS. As long as there's a profit making operation, which it is, there's another company called Flatter, which could make a go of it, and they're going to work with acceptable ads. I saw them at a conference in Amsterdam. I'm just forever dubious the way that's set up.
Yeah.
And the way they've acted is extortionate. That's my problem. They've blown it for me lifelong because the way they have acted.
Well, is there evidence that they've gone to somebody like Google and say, hey, your ads are blocked by our acceptable ad policy, but we would look the other way if you'd give us money? Don't the ads still have to? I think the ads still have to be adhere to the acceptable ad policy.
But what if you do an acceptable ad that you don't pay them? That's the issue, Leo.
It's they say 90% of the licenses that we grant are granted for free to smaller entities.
Yeah. Okay. So if you're a larger entity, if you're a big
larger
entity,
right, pay a licensing Google fee because you can afford
all these expenses. Afford what? Afford being blacklailed?
BS.
That's cover for them. That's pure cover for them. It's BS. All as Ron said, all these companies that are employing journalists that have these high expenses,
but they won't whitelist you if your ads are not acceptable, right?
They won't.
It's not like they whitelist ads that are unacceptable.
They won't whitelist you if you're big and don't pay them. That's the issue.
How about Procter & Gamble wants to run ads and they feel like all of their ads are acceptable, and then this company is like, no. But if you pay us, we'll whitelist you.
Well, that's an interesting question.
I think that's the point Jeff and Ron are trying to make.
Well, I would say they charge people some amount of money. They should be open about how much money.
They are. They say it's 30% of the additional revenue created by whitelisting. So the additional revenue you make from those whitelisted ads, 30% goes to AdBlock Plus.
That's insane. That's an insane.
That's what Apple charges if you sell something.
Yes, for an app store, which they host, right, and because it's a closed system and all that.
But again, that's only the top 10% of traffic generators. But they determine who's the top 10% based on how much ad blocking they're doing for those entities.
And those are entities that, in great measure, have journalistic costs and are suffering.
Well, no. They're the mostly it's like Google. It's Taboola. It's the big ad tech networks.
And Taboola is so acceptable and so friggin' wonderful.
Well, I don't know if they whitelist Taboola or not. I really don't think they would based on their criteria here. So this does two things. It pushes people. First of all, it's only the top 10% of traffic generators. The other 90% don't pay anything and are still whitelisted. The top 10%, the ad tech companies that make the most money from advertising, they say if you want to be whitelisted, you're going to have to give us 30% of the additional revenue from whitelisting. That doesn't seem unreasonable.
Yes, it does. It's crap.
This is like
Well, what's the alternative, which is we'll block everything and then you don't get any ads?
The alternative is that you have a truly independent, not-for-profit organization doing this. I'm all for profit. You know me. Every time on the show, I
doing
go
what?
On defending capitalism.
Doing the ad blocking?
Doing the ad setting.
Or doing setting the standard. Well, I think that they're
standard to start with. And then in terms of the actual blocking, then you can have an open source structure. You can get any blocker you want. If it does, that's why I've argued the publishers should create their own ad blocker.
What's funny is AdBlock Plus gets heat on both ends because users say, well, this should be acceptable ads should be turned off by default and we should decide if we want acceptable ads.
Right.
And then advertisers and people like you say, well, this is unacceptable because we don't want to have to pay for people to see our ads. I think you need to find a solution right now because you're in a world where people are just going to block ads.
I agree.
And by the way, there are a lot of ad blockers that just block everything. Period.
Yes, I know that too. Well, that's why I've written about this. I've argued that we in publishing, as Stacey said, we in publishing have to come up with our own standards. If you look at Quartz, a great story from Quartz in the early days, one of the founders, I don't know which one, really kind of hated advertising. I said, if we're going to have advertising, God damn it, this is what it's going to be. Well, that became an editor setting a structure for acceptable ads at Quartz. And Quartz has native advertising, but it's good, clearly labeled. And I think they do a good job because editorial took a role of responsibility in advocating for the public that we serve. The problem with advertising on websites is we screwed the public.
Right.
We threw more crap at their eyes.
Right.
We messed up. It's our own fault. I don't deny that. But the solution is not another conflict of interest, which you're right, Leo. Both AdBlock Plus and Google are in that conflict of interest. And Google's talking about having its own acceptable ads policy. Well, they have a similar conflict of interest. This needs to be some kind of independent organization. And it's not the IAB because
that's not independent. They represent advertisers.
Publishers and advertisers, right? It's not the Digital Content Next, formerly the Online Publishers Association. That's publishers. It needs to be somebody independent who also understands, as Ron said, the other really important point, that we need the eggs to feed the journalists.
Do you all unblock ads for specific sites? Like, I like Daring Fireball, so I'm going to unblock ads on those sites.
Yeah.
I don't run an ad blocker unless I'm on my phone.
Okay. Well, no, that's
I mean, I have in the past.
That's the best place to do it, but you do it on your phone.
I do.
Yeah. The irony is you can't do it I guess it's not exactly an irony. You can't do it on an Android. You have to run a separate browser. Google Chrome, the default browser in Android does not offer blocking.
Yeah, where you have to root, and that's a big mess.
Well, there's AdBlock Plus has a browser for Google, for Android and stuff, and Google, to their credit, at least doesn't block that from the store.
Should we mention the other case of pre-ad blocking that made news this week? I put it under numbers. I'm happy to
pre-ad blocking.
Like you. Ad blocks.
Before you buy. Your ad is blocked before you buy.
BuzzFeed turning down $1.3 million in Trump ads because they were equivalent, in Jonah's words, to cigarette advertising.
Oh. Ow.
Yeah, that's harsh.
Oh.
But they cover all his other stuff anyway, so.
He doesn't really need to buy the ads.
Oh, he sure doesn't.
In broadcast, you cannot turn down political ads. So broadcasters are, by the FCC, prohibited from turning down. I actually have to see what the rules are, but
I think there are some standards you can. There are standards,
obviously. Yeah.
So what they do? Is that why
fairness doctrine? No, yeah. That's airtime, but that's not. That doesn't relate to ads, does it?
Well, some of them say that we will not do any ads around issues, so that they don't get abortion ads they don't like or gun ads they don't like. So they just turn down all ads on issues. Which is not great either.
Let me look at the broadcast industry is so heavily regulated. I have to take regular tests for Clear Channel because I still do a radio show.
No, really?
I take tests every quarter about what the rules are. And
you have
what
to text on Morse code too?
No, tests on like payola. And the, Clear Channel got handed a massive fine for playing something, an ad for like White House Down that had Emergency Activation System tones in it.
That's right.
They had to pay a huge multi-million-dollar fine. And so now I have to take a test every 3 months on whether what tones I can play. It's incredible. Let me see what the, okay, here's the pre-election political advertising compliance checklist. This is from the Radio Advertising Bureau, so this is not from the government, but it is okay. So you have to, on your public file, contain all requests for freed and paid political time and their disposition. So clearly they want you to disclose, as BuzzFeed did, whether you turn something down. I don't know what the rules. You can't. So, you have to charge. The lowest. You can't give them a deal. Right. So you end up charging the top rate, the rack rate for the ads. I don't know if I'm going to be able to find the rule, but I'm pretty sure it's, as you might imagine, if you hold a license from the government to broadcast on TV or radio, that they don't want you to turn down ads for people you don't agree with. They want everybody to have access to those channels, right?
Well, it's also the argument about public airwaves and such.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
No. BuzzFeed's not, doesn't have that, nor do I have those restrictions.
So, nor does a cable network, right?
Cable does. Cable's FCC regulated, absolutely.
Are they regulated on that? They may be, are they regulated from, because the FCC stuff is over the public airwaves, which is broadcast.
I'm not sure.
Oh, I think FCC has some.
No.
The cable industry does do local and municipal franchise grants.
Yes,
now there's state levels. So maybe there's something there.
Not FCC.
I am not a telecommunications.
That's why I can say dirty words on cable. And that's why Howard Stern can say what he can say.
Well, yeah, no, but I mean, the FCC is not completely. I know people think they're stupid, but they might have different rules.
No.
They just don't have a legal right to.
Okay, maybe they don't.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think they do, but because remember, the cable companies have a monopoly because the FCC allowed
it. As Stacey says, that's a locally granted monopoly.
So when the FCC approves mergers, like big cable mergers, they can put conditions on things, but those conditions don't necessarily. I read through the Time Warner Cable and Charter conditions, and then there may have been something in NBCU and Comcast. So Comcast buying NBC Universal, they did make some conditions around content, like minority-owned stations and some things like that. But that falls apart after a certain time frame. I can't remember if it's 7 years.
Yeah, they do regulate the prices for advertising on cable television. There is a political
in cooperation with local franchising authorities.
It's in the FCC rules, Title 47, of the Federal Communications Commission, Communications Act 1934. They have to maintain a political file. They do a lot of the same things. I think there are different rules, perhaps, for broadcast and cable, but they are absolutely regulated. Even satellite.
Okay.
So
not when it comes to speech.
Well, that, like I said, you can have different rules. there's also the children's hour. You know, they allow you to say certain things after 11 p.m. There's stuff like that. Who is a legally qualified candidate for office? The equal opportunity access to advertising and to interviews and
on cable.
The political file.
You got me.
All right.
Well, relevant sections of the FCC's rules dealing with cable television systems. It's not the same, but there's definitely, this is cable rules like we're looking at as scrolling by.
Yeah.
Unhelping.
Rates and classes of time, sponsorship identification. This makes sense. I think it should be regulated.
Oh, I'm never in favor of regulating speech.
Well, anyway.
Well,
let's put it this way. BuzzFeed is not regulated. We know that. And so they could turn down Donald Trump. But I wonder, is that a good thing?
If they're transparent about it, sure.
What if Facebook said, we will not allow a Donald Trump page or any Donald Trump commentary?
We have a story on that about the whole rape thing, right? Users revolt, and then presumably you either modify your position or you just stick to it.
So BuzzFeed can get away with this because they're not dominant.
No, yeah, they can get away with it because they were transparent.
They're pure media. The argument is that Facebook's not, but let's push this. What if Donald Trump or a PAC for Donald Trump tried to put an ad up saying that Mexicans are all rapists and murderers?
That's different. They're turning down all advertising by the Republican candidate for president of the United States.
Yeah,
that's very different.
Generally.
Well, because he has said that all Mexicans are rapists.
No, they disagree with him politically.
No, they're saying
I think it's unprecedented. This is unprecedented.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a bad thing.
What if Vice said we're not going to take last election cycle? We're not going to do any ads for Barack Obama. We'll take all the ads for Mitt Romney.
And I think what would happen is Stacey's point. I think the users of Vice would probably have a proper fit. But at some point, this
only
country,
if
somebody's got to react to the insanity that we have in Donald Trump.
I think the difference is that
very
Facebook
dangerous.
Is a platform, and when you claim to be a platform, a certain amount of neutrality is expected. Where BuzzFeed is just a news outlet, and they can have a point of view.
It's a powerful.
I'm going to disagree. No, I'm going to disagree. So I think Facebook doesn't. They can do what they want, and I think it's important for people to remember this. So if Facebook says we don't want to run Donald Trump ads or we don't want to run Hillary Clinton ads. I mean, in DC, Facebook's lobbyists are mostly Republican. So let's take it Hillary Clinton ads. They can. And, as long as they say something to people, say, hey, you're never going to see this here because we don't agree with it. I'm actually okay with it. And if your users are mad, your users are going to tell you. And then we can have a really interesting conversation about the power of platforms and having one set of monopolistic tech platforms on the internet, and that could be really good for us.
I think you're right, Stacey, and I think for if you consider a platform, if we argue it's media, I actually am not sure it is, but fine for this discussion, argue that it is. Then for government to tell them what they have to take, I find great problems with that. Just as when
do you disagree though with the FCC requiring the cable and broadcast television except ads from Donald Trump? Do you disagree with that?
Yes. Yes.
You don't think the government should be in that
business? At some level, you have a responsibility. If somebody puts up a Nazi ad, even if you're running for president,
well, there are rules.
You absolutely should not.
Yeah, there are rules about like lying and payola.
But if it just says something that you find absolutely abhorrent and offensive, why should you be different from another media outlet? Because this is about free speech, and free speech includes what you don't say. What you do edit, which is, I've gotten some hot water about that recently. And the fact that when this, I think, BS Gawker story about the supposed anti-conservative stuff at Facebook Trends went on, then a member of Congress called him on carpet, and they went, we in press media should have been rallying behind Facebook and said, don't you dare go to Congress. You do not answer to Congress for what you say and don't say. That's the First Amendment. That is exactly what the First Amendment is about, is that Congress shall not pass laws regulating the press and speech. Shall not, period. Very simple. That's the essence of the First Amendment. You can't tell me what to say. You can't tell me what not to say. And at the end, I'm answerable to my public and my customers.
But clearly, I understand what you're saying, but clearly that is not how we've been doing business up to now. And it's been...
And I hate the FCC for it.
Okay.
I've written cover stories about, and this is why Howard Stern got driven. And I argued that I'm going to say a word now. Watch out. Put it in the rundown. Bull is political speech. Now, the fact that you're going to have to knock that out there, because in this case, you're dealing with a private argument, which is
Apple. I just choose to.
You choose to, but Apple could do it.
It has nothing to do with Apple. I just choose to.
We were on broadcast, right? And BS, I'll be okay now, is political speech. If you can't call BS, what is more political speech than that? How is it that we decide that that's nasty? Who decided that that's nasty? Who set that standard? Government should have nothing, not a zero to do with that. Nothing.
Wow.
So in these FCC rules, because I've been looking at them because I think we're a little confused and I'm not ready to be like, I am the authority because I've read a couple of these pages.
I love having you on the show, Stacey.
But they have under the broadcast rules, and this is kind of interesting, broadcasting, they have a prohibition against broadcasting false information.
Right.
And it says you can't broadcast false information. Oh, but it's only during a crime or catastrophe if the licensee knows the information is false,
right.
Which in a lot of ways would exclude a lot of Donald Trump
ads are different. People always thought that ads had to be true. That's the FTC, and they're not that stringent. General truthiness.
Truthiness works. I don't actually see under the cable and satellite specific stuff about political ads. And that's what I
keep going, because there is a whole section that talks about who is a candidate, who's not a candidate. They have to maintain what's called a political file, which shows to the public what they've turned down, what they've accepted.
And I think that's great. I mean, that's kind of a bare minimum.
What I don't know is what the rules are on you must accept political advertising. Yeah. I know broadcasters are required to accept, I believe broadcasters are required to accept political advertising.
Oh, they quite like getting political advertising because it's
yeah,
it's,
that's it's why I don't know, because they would never turn it down. By the way, BuzzFeed turned down $1.3 million from Trump. This was not a small buy. And I love it. Jake Berube, who's a senior advertising executive at the Daily Caller, said, hey, I'd name, which is a conservative news website, I'd literally name my firstborn Bernie Clinton for $1.3 million. I can't imagine turning down that kind of money for any reason. So I guess you could say it's a principled stand, but it worries me a little bit. But it would only worry me if there weren't other sources of news than BuzzFeed.
Yeah, but there's a point, I'm not going to get you in trouble with your audience and go into political stuff. So folks, I'm just going to do this for the sake of the argument. Okay, let me do that, please.
Well, just flip it. Use the other candidates.
No. I'm going to say that if Hitler ran for president, at some point, what's the line of responsibility? And the platform is that Jews are evil.
Yeah, I understand. But at the point if the Republican Party nominated him, I guess you'd have to.
Well, no, even then. What if the Republican Party has gone crackers?
No, you're right. You should be able to say, I'm not going to take ads from this guy. You're right. I agree.
Yeah, I think you can be selective.
Yeah.
And also, what if you are, do it another way. What if you're Fox and Hillary Clinton wants to run an ad saying all Republicans are Donald Trump is this or that?
Right.
I think Fox has a right not to run it.
Okay. No, good. We're done.
All right.
I think you made an excellent point. Well, I don't want to belabor it. We will talk about the Supreme Court.
That's my specialty, Leo. That's what I do is belabor things.
We will talk about the Supreme Court and the Google class action lawsuit, which the Supreme Court has agreed can continue in just a bit. Lots more to talk about. Jeff Jarvis is here. Professor Jarvis from the City University of New York, where he's a widely respected liberal.
How do we end up in Tennessee Williams?
I don't know. I think I'm Strom Thurmond. But anyway. Also, Ron Amadio from Ars Technica is wisely just stepping back a little bit, just take a little step back. We'll get to the geek stuff. And we will also continue with Stacey Higginbotham, our newest member of the crew. So glad to have Stacey on IoT and Giga Stacey joining us for the show today. I will be standing up as I do my show. I like to stand up. I always did TV standing up, and I often did radio standing up. A standing desk is awesome because it kind of keeps the blood going and stuff. But sometimes you want to sit down. Sometimes you're tired. You don't want to stand up. Wouldn't it be nice to have a desk that could do both? Well, Varidesk can. That's where the name comes from. It's variable. Varidesk. If you spend a lot of time sitting at your computer, you should know that being sedentary is widely agreed. Being sedentary is not good for you. Mayo Clinic says sitting puts you at a greater risk for obesity, increased blood pressure, high blood sugar. It's nice. It's just nice for your energy to be able to stand and sit and move around. Varidesk is so great because it sits on top of your existing desk or cubicle, means no boss approval required. There's no installation or assembly either. It just comes in a box. You take it out, you put it on your desk, and suddenly put your gear on it, your monitors on it. You can raise and lower it. Varidesks are adjustable from 11 different height settings. You just put your fingers on handles on either side. It's spring-loaded, so you don't have to heft it up. It just goes up and down no matter, even if you have a couple of monitors on there. And it's affordable, too. Prices start as low as $175 with free shipping in the continental United States. Lifehacker called Varidesk one of their 5 best standing desks. It's been featured on Product Hunt, Gear Patrol, and we are very happy to have Varidesks in our new studio, much as Pied Piper did in their new offices in Silicon Valley. Of course, they got kicked out of those offices after about 4 episodes, but we're going to have them for a little longer than that, I hope. We just love the Varidesk. All our desks in the new studio are going to be Varidesks. Varidesk.com, if you want to learn more, check out their wide range of height-adjustable desks, your desk, your cubicle, no boss approval required. In fact, in all likelihood, the boss will come over and say, "Where'd you get that? I want one." And make sure you tell him you heard about it on Twitter. V-A-R-I, Varidesk.com. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Google. Android M, the name is going to be unveiled in a few weeks. What do you think, panel? Nut roll?
Woo.
Nougat? Nutella?
Nutella.
It's amazing how much they've turned the name into like a news cycle thing where it's like, man, whatever, just call it something. And
yeah, it's just a code name for crying out loud. We know, I mean, it's Android 7, right? I mean, it's just a code name.
It's beyond 6. Yeah, who knows what they'll actually
number. Oh, it could be 6.1, I guess, huh?
Yeah, or 5, or I don't know. They go crazy with version numbers, who knows? But I wonder if that means like releases coming in a few weeks or what. It's supposed to be Q3, right? Yeah. Is that in a few weeks? I don't know.
No.
No.
Okay.
God, I hope not. Please, no. So yeah, they tweeted, "Thanks for your submissions. We'll reveal the new name in a few weeks." And they did that today. So, with a little pretty little video, you know, I just want to say the problem with Nutella, of course, is it's commercial, but you can make your own Nutella. Okay. I was at Whole Foods the other day, and you know how they have the peanut grinder and the almond grinder, and you make fresh peanut butter, almond butter? In the middle, they had hazelnuts and chocolate chips, and you grind it, and it goes in together to make a delicious treat.
Wow.
Make your own Nutella.
Not Nutella trademark.
It's not Nutella. Right. What
you
is it?
You could call it Nutella.
Nutella. Oh. I should have looked carefully to see what the sign is. Maybe there is such a thing as a non-Nutella Nutella. It was so good. By the way, much better than that plastic stuff.
Hazelnut chocolate spread?
Yeah. That's... Android hazelnut chocolate spread? No.
No, it's got to start with the end.
Got to start with the end.
Chocolate hazelnut spread is what they call it.
Oh. You looked it up. Jeff's looking it up.
Yeah, it makes sense. You would emphasize the chocolate first as opposed to the healthier.
It looks a little like baby poop.
Yeah.
But it's...
They have a recipe and ingredients online at Whole Foods.
Yeah. Well, what is in it? Just hazelnuts and dark chocolate,
one
right?
One-third cup almonds, one-third cup hazelnuts. One and one-third cup hazelnuts, one and one-third cups sweetened plain almond milk, one cup pitted dates.
No, this is not what...
Unsweetened cocoa powder, one tablespoon pure vanilla extract.
No. That's terrible. Yeah. This
that
was just
kind of healthy.
No, this was hazelnuts and dark chocolate chips in a thing. You turn the knob, and it has this kind of not that. That's a spread.
When does Twit do
What's
a cooking show? This would be a good podcast.
I would love to be on the cooking show.
I'll tell you
Leo in the kitchen making something.
There's no news in asparagus, as a wise friend of mine once said.
Why? Did you were pitching an asparagus story?
Well, that was when we worked my friend Joan Feeney when we worked on Epicurious.
Epicurious.
Hard to do a news
awesome.
Section because there's no news in asparagus.
Well, that's true. But we found the news in Nutella or Nut Roll or Nougat or Nutty Buddy or Nerds or.
Yeah, there's not that many options. I can't believe they made like a submission thing. Like, there's probably only 10 names you could come up with that actually work.
There's got to be Nutella.
There's got to be an end pie of some sort, right? Or cake. No, I'm really having...
Nilla vanilla wafer pie.
They
Nilla
said wafers. It didn't have to be a dessert. Are they going to break precedent?
What?
They said that. Oh, yeah, they said it could be anything.
Nutella really isn't a dessert, let's be honest. It's a breakfast spread.
No, that is a dessert. In my house, that is a no food or a woe food.
you have a classification system, Stacey. Tell us more.
No, woe, slow, and go.
Oh, my God. I need this.
Oh, that's amazing.
Do you have colored stickers?
No. That's crazy talk. That's insane.
Wait a minute. No, go, woe, or slow. Whoa. What does woe mean?
No, woe, slow, or go. So no is absolutely not.
None.
It's like Jello shots. You cannot have Jello.
No,
shots.
That's go.
Well, age dependent.
Okay.
Our classification. Okay. Woe is like, it's like cakes or pies or
so a little bit.
A little bit's good for you. Slow is
Nutella would be a woe.
Nutella's a woe.
Or maybe a slow.
Yeah, Nutella's a woe. And then slow is things like, I don't know, mac and cheese. And then go veggies.
I have got to adopt this.
Is that your invention, Stacey? Is that your invention?
No. My daughter came home from school with it.
This is awesome.
Oh, really? Oh.
No go, woe, or slow. Do you act, how strictly do you adhere to this? And where does Chipotle fall on the scale?
Me, that's a go.
That's pretty
for
awesome.
A lot of people, that's a go.
Go.
Is it a go?
Was it a stop for a while? Was it a woe for a while?
Yeah.
Not for me.
Depends how you feel about E. coli. Oh. It would just be, you know.
I'm from Texas. We're like,
actually, there's strong evidence now. What did I read? I read a study of children in Finland and then across the border in Russia. And the children in Finland had a much higher incidence of asthma and other autoimmune diseases than the children in Russia, even though they grew up in almost identical climates. The only difference was the Finnish were very clean. They were even genetically similar because, you know, the cross-border pollination. But the Finns were too clean. And so the kids were not exposed to the flora and fauna. And they actually think it comes down to the gut flora.
Oh, like your biome?
Yeah.
I can believe it. Like more diversity in your gut flora?
What they did is they examined the gut flora and they found a significant difference between those two groups. And then they were able to, I should find this study because it was fascinating. And then we're able to kind of look at other groups and see that in fact, this might be well related to the immune issues and asthma and other things. So,
okay.
If you're in Finland, whoa. If you're in Russia, go. Poor Ron's thinking, what am I doing here?
He's like, what?
No, I'm getting tweeted that there's a, Apple announced that they rearranged their app store split. So it's, what is it?
It's not 30% anymore?
No. Is it 15-85? Yeah. They re-announced the app store split to 85-15, like share with the
developer.
That's
huge.
And Google was just like, yeah, we're going to do that too. It's cool.
That's just happening?
That is big.
Yes, 4 hours ago. Apple details App Store changes, including new subscription revenue split and search result ads. Ooh. This is Phil Schiller's doing. He added the App Store to his role at Apple just 6 months ago. Apple is going to start showing search ads for apps in its iOS App Store search results for the first time.
So I was at a Google Play event in London just yesterday, and they said that the average number of users has 16 apps they use per month. Are apps trailing? Is that the problem here? Apps are people just 16. Aren't using apps as much?
Actually, that's a normal person.
Yes, I know, but then when you get to scale, that's the issue.
But on your front page, on your iPhone, how many icons?
It doesn't matter. How many do you use? I've got tons of icons.
But on the front page, which is the stuff that you use most, right?
Yeah, but Stephen, there are plenty.
That's like 20, right?
It depends on how many have there.
We've talked about this before. I'm willing to bet most people do not add many apps. They just use the apps the phone comes with. Most normal people, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And those that, like, I've got Duolingo still sitting there, which is great.
Right.
I'm trying to get myself to use it because I want to learn my Spanish, but I don't.
I have 200 apps on my Android device, but I guarantee you I don't use.
I have Kindle there, but I don't read Kindle every month. Right. I read books other ways. You know, I have Authy there. Does that count? I mean, it's just. So is the app business just not as good as we thought? And they're trying to encourage more development.
Maybe. I mean, there's no lack of apps.
And don't forget, here's the other thing. I met with the PA, the program, whatever you call them, product manager for Instant Apps in London. Really, really good guy. And found it, you know, really fascinating to keep thinking about the impact of Instant Apps. I also talked to another guy because I was giving this talk at this event. I wanted to learn more. And their presumption is that people, you know, they recognize huge friction to download and remember to use an app. Huge friction. Every publisher says those are our most valuable users, but there's so few of them, and it's really hard to get them to go. So if you can pull a chunk of an app into the web, what's going to happen? Is this going to act as marketing for the apps where people will download it? Maybe in some cases. But in a lot of cases, they'll never use the app. This is the way you'll get engagement with your app, is by chunking it out.
No, I love this. This instant app thing is great. By the way, just to clarify, the new deal that Apple's offering is not for app purchases. That will continue to be 70-30. This is for subscription apps where there is a regular subscription. And I'm going to tell you exactly why they did this. Subscription-based apps will see that models change to 85-15 if the customer subscription has been active for at least 1 year. So the first year will be 70-30. Subsequent years will be 85-15.
Oh, this is this also, to address issues from like Spotify and publishers?
Yep. Yeah, that's what this is.
Yeah, publishers have been saying, screw you. I'm going to take it outside.
That's exactly what this is. And I bet you there's significant pressure from not just Spotify, but Amazon.
Washington Post. The Economist,
yep.
FT.
All the publishers. Less so Amazon. Amazon, because those are individual purchases, aren't they? So it wouldn't be Amazon. I feel like Apple really wants to get the Amazon app on the Apple TV, and Amazon is saying, and I think they've said this publicly, we got to have a better deal. We can't do this 70-30 thing when people buy stuff.
So Apple, I think, is changing the split after the first year of the subscription.
Right.
Where Google's doing it right away.
Interesting. We get a little, baby.
They had to jump in and one up on
competition, baby. Free market, baby. Can you say capitalism? Sorry.
On Android, last I saw, the average number of apps installed was 95, which sounds insanely high.
I believe, though, that only 16 are being used.
I was about to say installed. I totally would buy it.
Google will offer app developers same revenue sharing terms that Apple just announced, except that it starts instantly. Wow. Now, wait a minute, though. Let me look at that, because Apple did not change the rev share. This is only on subscriptions.
So it's only subscriptions.
Is this for all of the Google Play Store or just subscriptions?
Oh,
new pricing plan. It'll be a strategy to find a revenue. Giving app developers the ability, scroll up a little more, other way, Other way,
up versus down.
Oh,
like GIF versus GIF.
And yeah, I don't want to see
the. No, it says the second paragraph. It says it will move from a 70-30
for subscriptions. For subscriptions. Yeah. Okay. So not for in-app purchases and not for app buys, but for renewing subscriptions. So yeah, that is. I mean, what are your subscriptions? It's mostly music and newspapers, right? Publications.
You might have like a smart home kind of device, like a camera subscription, but you're not going to buy that through that app store.
These language learning things? There's lots of them.
Okay. Oh, there are lots of them. Yeah, Headspace, our advertiser Headspace, the meditation program. That's a subscription.
Yeah, this is just a straight up API. You can use it for whatever you want, I would assume.
Yeah. I'm just wondering how people use it.
Yeah.
Is the UPS guy there again, Stacey? You want to run?
It's either UPS or my husband's home. Sorry.
Don't confuse the two, Stacey. You can get in a lot of trouble. Just warning you. There's go and there's whoa.
I think that's a no.
That's a no. Ron Amato, I'm sure you were watching Lenovo Motorola's feed this morning. What did they announce?
That's tomorrow.
Oh, I thought they were doing it today.
Oh. I thought it was tomorrow.
The Moto Z.
I definitely did not watch it.
Oh, well, neither did I, but I guess if it's tomorrow, that's why.
Yeah, Tech World is the 9th. It's not the 9th, right?
Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's weird. Lenovo wants to host like a... I don't know. It's like kind of a developer conference. Like it's clearly that they want to emulate like Google I/O and WWDC.
Samsung does that too, but who goes, right? Why?
But it's like Lenovo doesn't have any platforms. At least Samsung makes like Tizen and there's some APIs, but Lenovo only ships like Windows and Android devices. So I don't know what people are going to do at this thing. But yeah, it's tomorrow in San Francisco. We're expecting to see like a new Motorola phone, either the new like Motorola flagship, I would assume, which is going to be called the Z or the X maybe. And then there's going to be a Project Tango show going on too, which Lenovo is making the first Project Tango device, which if you don't know, Project Tango is kind of like a, imagine like an Xbox Kinect slapped onto the back of a smartphone. Like it's computer vision. So like you point it at a scene and it can take like a 3D map of it.
Right.
And kind of pass that off to developers, and that'll do things like indoor mapping or funky augmented reality video games, stuff like that.
That's really not a consumer product, is Tango? I mean...
Yeah, this is the first consumer Project Tango device.
What am I going to use that for?
I'm not saying it's going to be good.
You could superimpose things. Like, I look at something like that for, like, assembling IKEA furniture, right? You could superimpose...
Oh, all right. Okay. So it's like augmented reality.
Well, there's an AR component. It's not just that. There's also, I mean, the mapping stuff is actually kind of cool. But again, it relies on you looking through the world through your phone, which is kind of a lame thing.
It really seems like one day they're going to strap this to like a funky version of Google Glass. And, you know, you just need to get all the programming done, and then you kind of replace the camera part with like a transparent sheet.
I still
think you can do all the augmented reality.
Blind people. I think that if you could use it with audio cues and buzzing cues.
Haptic feedback.
Knowing a space. Yes, haptic feedback to say, don't go there. Whoa, go. Slow. or you say, this is where I want to go, and it helps you find something. Knowing the space, and then also knowing objects in the space. Where the hell did I put my blank?
Oh, my gosh. Tracker has that. They got in July, they're going to launch their Atlas plug. And Tracker is that device thing. Actually, I think they're an advertiser on this show. What it does is you can actually, it ties into the Amazon Echo, and you can say, Echo, where are my keys? And she'll be able to say, in the living room.
Wow.
So that it's an outlet plus the trackers, like the individual tracking units that are going to create this. So if you think about that, plus, you know, for haptic feedback on like a phone or something, communicating
warmer,
that same, like hot or cold. Yes.
Yeah. Do you know how it gets its location?
It does. I do. It's Bluetooth and Wi-Fi triangulation.
Ah.
How does it know what the living room is versus
Wi-Fi
the den?
Wi-Fi triangulation. Wow.
The problem with Wi-Fi triangulation, I understand, because there's a lot of Wi-Fi access points, but are there a lot of Bluetooth? Are you'd have to.
There are going to be a lot more Bluetooth, and the next gen Bluetooth standard is going to have Bluetooth mesh.
Actually, yeah.
And I've talked to the SIG, and they want to do a
That's
location
a good idea.
Option.
So then you have indoor location.
So, I mean, it's not here today. It could be.
Well, but I think now that I think of it, when I turn on pairing on my phone, I do see a lot of things. Like I see the Roku, I see remotes. There are other things. Normally you don't want your Bluetooth to be visible. I mean, that's a big deal. You don't leave your phone or your Bluetooth device in constant pairing mode because you don't want to be visible and be snarfed. But maybe these new devices, especially with LE and whatever they're coming along with, Bluetooth 8, they'll be always
four
something. They'll always be kind of saying, "Hey, I'm over here." And you can't you know with Wi-Fi you could triangulate the signal by signal strength. You could actually do pretty good location.
Yeah, and they're yeah. So I don't know. I think it's neat. When they come out, I'm totally going to get one so I can. It's actually three of them for sitting throughout my house, and then I'm going to play with this because
that's cool.
I'm so psyched.
Great
about
IoT story. Yes.
Yeah, so that would be awesome.
It is. Can I just, since Stacey brought up this topic, I just want to, this most amusing thing I learned when I was gone for this week.
What?
She mentioned IKEA chair. Yeah. I know this is off topic, but I got to say this. I heard a speech at Newsgeist from the holder of the only IKEA chair at a university in Sweden. Isn't that just too great?
Oh, now that's an endowment I'd want.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. The Perfect. IKEA chair. Did he have to assemble it himself, or did it come
Yes, it's actually known as hoo-ha.
Google did an interesting... I guess we should take a break. I'm just looking at the time. Yeah, let me take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about a new app from Google for iOS, not Android. They're doing more of this lately. I'm worried.
Yo.
This is like Microsoft, right? Microsoft now does stuff not for their phone, but for everybody else's phone. But Google, really? First, a word from Atlassian. If you're a programmer, a developer, if you work on a team, you probably use Atlassian. I use Atlassian. We use Atlassian all the time. We first got introduced to Atlassian's Jira, which is an incredible project management tool for agile teams, for teams working on a project, even really complex projects. It lets you keep track of issues, keep track of who's doing what, what the assignments are. We used it for designing our new website. That's my first introduction to it. We use it all the time now. Our developers for our new apps are using it. So you can. It's great. In fact, we use it for maintenance too. Our maintenance contract on our website. So we can put up problems and have them solved and have them prioritized, assign, track, and manage tasks. No matter how complex the project gets, Jira is awesome. And then there's Confluence, which lets you create and share content, organize results, bring team members up to speed. We use Confluence kind of as issue ticket within the enterprise. Russell uses this. HipChat, we live on HipChat. HipChat's awesome. In fact, I get HipChat notifications all the time. I was just showing my notifications on Windows Weekly because we're working on the new studio, and of course when you're working on a new studio, we've got architects, contractors, engineers, lighting and camera guys, wiring guys. There's a big team involved. And HipChat, everybody puts everything into HipChat. We had to actually train some of the people who'd never used it before because they'd send emails or something. No, put it in HipChat. And then it's all in one place. It's both synchronous and asynchronous, so you can have real-time conversations. It's kind of like an instant messenger that way. But everything is there. There's this great history. So you can go back. You can see Ryan's putting his designs in there because it handles images just fine. It handles all sorts of integrations with all sorts of devices. We have it integrated with Panopta, for instance. And now I get alerts if our server goes down or there's issues with the mail. It is amazing. And then Bitbucket, which lets you test, review, and manage code in real time. This is a company doing solid tools for people who are getting things done. We love all the Atlassian programs, and I think you will too. If you aren't using Atlassian yet, go to Atlassian.com and see how Jira and Confluence and HipChat and Bitbucket can give your team everything you need to organize, discuss, and complete. That's really important. Great artists ship complete shared work. Atlassian, helping teams everywhere team up to create what's next. I love Atlassian. I have to say, we live on HipChat. And Jira is amazing. If you've never used Jira and you get the board, and then you get the burn down, and it shows you graphs, and it's just really incredible. I've never seen it anything like it. Let's talk about the Google Motion Stills app. I don't have an iPhone with me, so I wasn't able to try it today. Have you tried it yet, Ron?
No, I have not. I have an iPhone somewhere around here. But,
there you go. That's
like I can already make GIFs, so I don't know.
Well, I have to tell you, so this takes those great live photos that the iPhone does. That was something Apple added with the iPhone 6S, I guess. The idea is you take a picture, kind of like what HTC did with their Zoes. So you're taking a still, and the key, and it takes a while to train yourself, is to put the camera up, wait a moment, take the picture, and then leave the camera up, because you're going to get not only the still, but a 3-second video around the still. And then when you press and hold the image, it comes to life. It's very cool. It's a Harry Potter kind of a thing. But it's the way Apple does it is incompatible with everybody. I'm sure Google did this because people were uploading these live images to Google Photos and saying, what happened to the live? Because really what it is a still, a JPEG still, and an MOV file, a kind of a low-res MOV file shot at the same time. So Google's put out an app, this is iPhone only, that will take those photos and turn them into animated GIFs. And by the way, do some smoothing. This is Paul Thurrott has been using it, so I'm going to steal some stuff from his site, Thurrott.com. So the animated GIF is great because that works everywhere. And then the smoothing is important because, as you probably know, if you've ever used the automated GIFs from the Google Photos, you know, if you take a burst, it will say, hey, I could animate that, but there's often very jerky. So the smoothing is kind of neat. Only negative is this stupid logo. See this in this little... That's on all your pictures. I don't... Maybe just on your GIFs.
Yeah, and Google had said they plan on building this into Google Photos at some point.
Good.
So it will actually make it to Android eventually. The HTC thing is interesting because when they did the whole Zoe thing, they
had loved these three, Zoes.
They had these 3-second videos and they had nowhere to put them because right. Like if you upload them to YouTube or something, that really sucks. So HTC's response was to build an entire social network into the Zoe app, and you could like share Zoes with your friends who are also HTC customers. It was totally ridiculous.
Yeah,
but turning them into GIFs is a good solution for getting that content out to actual social networks that people use.
Yeah, you need a standard, don't you?
Yeah.
I'm going to look at my assistant here because what's fun, let me see if I have any animations. What's fun is the way it will take burst mode photos and animate them. I guess this is asking if I want to create an animation. That's no good.
There should be a section called Assistant that would have...
Yeah, I'm in it. I'm just seeing. Stuff. It has a lot of... Because my son graduated from high school a year ago, so 3 years ago. So I have a lot of pictures. Here we go. Here's an animated picture of our Kikis. Now, see, if they put this... the reason that looks like that is because it was three photos shot close in time, but not with the intent of animating them. But if they had some smoothing and interpolation and stuff, that could make it more interesting.
I don't know. I kind of like the kind of glitchiness of it. It's a little bit, it's like a flip book.
It is like a flip book. Yeah.
I feel like the internet loves stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, we're getting used to it.
Yeah. The demo on, this is from like the Google research team, which is pretty crazy. And the demo of it is like, the stabilization wasn't just the weird YouTube stabilization where everything kind of
it's jelly.
Turns into jello.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had like, it looked like they were getting some kind of point cloud, like out of your video. Like they showed little dots on everything in the background. Like it was getting kind of like a real 3D look at things and then could use that to stabilize the camera. It seems like the stabilization would be really good and advanced, especially coming out of the research section.
I have to say, I just love Google Photos. The fact that they made a photo album out of my son's graduation. I forgot this was 2013. It's just really great to have. You know, in fact, I sent a link. I saw this in my photos, and I sent a link to my son. I said, remember this day 3 years ago? Isn't that cool? Just that it does that for you? I love that. So you said they're putting more AI. They're going to do more with the photos?
Well, Photos already uses AI for all of the search stuff. Right. Like, you can type
it's
in
amazing,
cars,
isn't it?
And yeah. You'll get it will, like, recognize that there's cars in your thing and show them. It sounds like this thing uses a good amount of machine learning, too, to get the kind of – to train the video right. stabilization software, I guess.
Interesting. I like it when companies take the stuff that's in the labs and just put them out as not necessarily a complete product or – just do it because it's fun. It's cool.
So Facebook has done a similar image search on, like, if you search horses, it will show you pictures of horses, for example. So they're doing a similar thing with their AI or machine learning efforts. And then, I'm just offering
this. What everybody does. I was like, oh, I can do that. Oh, we got that in the lab. Yeah.
They're using they're if they haven't applied it, they're starting to apply it in different parts of their business. So they used machine learning for images to do their maps for showing where internet connectivity wasn't. They took the machine learning model that they trained to recognize geophysical things. They took satellite maps of the world, and then they used their machine learning model to figure out where people lived. So they could figure out where to try to fly their drones, or they're doing the drones, right?
Yeah.
Their lasers, their balloons, their
everybody's whatever. Doing it all the same stuff, right?
Yeah. And then Shutterstock actually uses a similar machine learning algorithm to show you, and this is kind of interesting, the best possible outcome or the best possible photograph to purchase. If you search for like horses, and they said that they saw, I think it was an 80% increase in their sales in the first week, which is pretty cool. And that's actually, it's worth saying that they optimized for a different.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I was like, did y'all lose? No. But they optimized for sales versus like accuracy of the image or something you might like more, which I think is cool. I don't know.
One thing I don't want Google to do is compose music.
Oh, that was terrible.
They're calling it Project Magenta, which, by the way, is not just for music. Magenta is machine intelligence in the arts. So it's going to do music. It's going to do arts. It's going to do stories. I was asking Carsten if he could find the Magenta music to play for us. This is the first machine-made song from Google's Magenta. Now, I have to point out that it only is using four notes, C, C, G, and G, which sounds like two notes to me, but I guess music people know that there's differences. I don't know. Carson's looking for the song to play. But again, we're in the infancy, and these are two-year-olds, basically. This is the very beginning of machine learning. They haven't learned much yet.
Yeah, I don't see how generated music is particularly interesting, though. The art thing is really weird.
Look at this. This is kind of psychedelic, isn't it? It's very Geiger, H.R. Geiger. I'll wait. Hold on a sec. There you go. It sounds like a three-year-old at a piano.
Why would they just do four notes?
I don't know, because it's a brain that's not so smart. I don't know.
I was about to say, it's probably limiting them. Yeah,
wait a
the
minute.
Beat.
Here comes the drum.
Oh, okay. That's good. Still boring.
I don't know. Is it boring? It's dopey.
Yeah, not impressed.
Okay, now listen to this and look at the psychedelic art that I've got on my screen. Now, what would you say? that's the art Magenta made.
That's at least weird. That's like beyond something any person would make.
I kind of like this. This very, like I said, H.R. Geiger. Okay, enough of the googly CCGG.
They're totally different. One's very cheerful and happy and innocent sounding because it sounds like a kid's playing it.
Yeah.
And then that art is the dark underbelly of the internet.
Yeah.
And the art is also like extremely complex, which is what this stuff is good at, I feel like.
Yeah, the music is not, is it?
Yeah, I think anybody could pound away on four notes and come up with something like that. But if you handed me a pencil, I could definitely not draw whatever that weird black thing was.
Here's a video. This is not working. I don't know what's going on there. A video based on Deep Dream, which is that Google AI, you know, that looks at stuff and then does stuff.
It looks like an LSD trip.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of this does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There's probably something to be derived from that observation, but I'm not sure what.
I don't know. I would say, so for creativity, I have to say this is actually way more compelling than IBM's Watson creativity efforts, which were around cooking. I mean, the results of that are awesome.
Have you had any of Watson's cooking?
Yes.
Is it or go or slow or no?
It's delicious. Different foods
really?
Are different.
Where have you had it? And tell us about it.
Oh, okay. It was South by Southwest. I think it was, what year is it? Okay, it was 20.
A human did it, right? I mean, the recipe was from Watson.
Watson takes like a bunch of different things, like including like what flavors are paired in different regions. And then it's got a thing that says like, these are the types of things people are most attracted
sweet
to.
Sweet and salty
profile.
And right.
Yeah. So then it takes those things and it spits out random recipe pairings. And then someone from, I think it's like, maybe it's the Cordon Bleu school. Maybe it's somebody else. They actually cook it. So they did this awesome dinner at South By. And the coolest and most delicious pairing was like these olives and cherries, like tapenade kind of thing. And it was delicious. But some of them
olives and cherries tapenade.
Yeah, it was
that
really
sounds
good.
Like food only a computer could generate. I don't think a human would think of that.
Well, I thought it was really exciting because
sweet and salty. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't think of it. And there you go. And they have the cookbook and I've seen the cookbook, but I've not made anything out of the cookbook. So I can't tell you about that. We can put that on our kitchen.
I'm going to get, I'm going to get that cookbook.
I bet IBM will send it to you.
Not sold in stores.
It is sold in stores, actually. Oh. I think
sold in stores. U.S. Supreme Court is going to let the Google advertising class action suit go forward. They let stand a lower court's decision to allow a class action lawsuit. So that doesn't mean it's going to the Supreme Court, but they didn't block the lower court from having the trial.
It's a fairly limited. I think there's a case here, too. It's from 2004 to 2008, and Google was putting ads on junk pages. People were paying for it.
It accused Google of violating the California Fair Advertising Laws because it told advertisers, it misled advertisers about where the ads were going to go. The AdWords, of course, puts ads next to search results, but Google should also have told the advertisers it would also appear, their ads would also appear in undesirable places like error pages and parked domains. But I don't think Google did that on purpose, right? Isn't that AdWords? I mean,
yeah, people are free to put AdWord blocks
on anything
wherever they want, aren't they?
Right.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I think Google has some measure of standards they need to set.
Yeah, but I mean,
that.
if it's just an embed, if I have an AdWords account and I put AdWords on my 404 page, I mean, it was very common practice to do that with.
It was at the time, yes.
Yeah, right. With search errors. Or with parking domains, you see a lot of parked domains that would just have a whole, you know, three columns of ads. I don't know if you buy Google AdWords.
Well, wasn't this in early days?
Yeah, I was just going to say I would think this is fixed today, and this is just a really old lawsuit. Right.
That's what I'm saying is that I think it was an issue, and it was fixed, and they went. Damages, which is, you know.
Apparently, you can thank Scalia for the Supreme Court not getting involved in this. Normally, the Supreme Court did not like to take class action suits. But Scalia loved them. I don't know. So he didn't love them in the sense he loved class action suits, but he would take them in order to overturn them.
He didn't, doubt, yeah.
He didn't like them, but he loved to take them, if that makes any sense.
I just put something on the rundown that I think will interest you.
Yes.
So Zuckerberg just hired College Humor co-founder Ricky Van Veen to become the head of global creative strategy for Facebook. And in our constant discussion of whether the platforms have their own content, this looks like an interesting turn.
Yeah, I mean, that's hiring a content guy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Got to have a Facebook original series.
Well, it's going to be focused on getting more interesting stuff into Facebook's live video as well as 360 video format. Note, of course, they're paying some celebrities and media companies, including Vox, to which writes about the story, to make video.
That's interesting.
New York Times and others. I'll be working with all types of creators and organizations to figure out how best to use the biggest network in the world to better connect people with engaging and meaningful content, he wrote in a Facebook post. Reporting to VP of Content Nick Gruden. Nick is a good guy who also works with a lot of works with news at a very high level in the company. I found this really interesting move. My friend Fred Graver, who's now a Twitter ex big TV guy of his own sort, just tweeted about it. So I thought,
and from the chat room, this is cool. Bon Appetit has a website, IBMChefWatson.com.
Oh, gosh. There you go.
Where you can get help from Watson. So pick an ingredient. And here, let me go back to the beginning because this is kind of cool. So it's empty. You can look for ingredients. So let's say, what goes well with aged rum? And pumpkin, strawberry, and clove would be good. So here's aged rum stuffing, pudding. Here's an aged rum sandwich featuring ground chuck, honey, aged rum, French bread, carrot, pumpkin, green beef, olive oil, strawberry, and clove.
Yeah, I like that there's no picture for that one.
Yum! Nobody ever made that one. Here's aged rum fish dish, aged rum. So this is, how about cini di pepe? And aged rum. I don't know, but it makes a great linguine.
Pick an ingredient, guys.
You can actually see I'm mixing and matching here. Now I've got aged rum lasagna featuring
a chini. What's an impossible ingredient?
I would have thought, you can't add an almond macaroon to aged rum, a chini de pepe, and Aleppo pepper, can you? Nope. No recipe with this makes sense at all. All right, let's take out a few of these. And orange juice, chicken, pineapple, and red wine, celeriac, apple, and coffee bean. And you're going to get...
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
But I can see how that would help. Okay.
How about a red wine spritzer? Horrible.
Oh.
Red wine, soda water, celeriac, lime juice, apple, and coffee beans.
Only
a computer could create that. Although apparently somebody has.
What's that horrible black goo that Brits like?
Marmite? Should I see what we can do with Marmite?
See what I can do with Marmite. But nothing
goes with Marmite. Marmalade. They don't have Marmite. They have Marmalade.
What's the Australian?
Marsalia. Vegemite.
There's a search box.
That's a brand name, though, right? Oh, search. Oh, you're so smart. This is why you get the big bucks at Ars Technica. No, those are brand names. That's why. This is...
I think Brussels sprouts are inedible myself.
Oh, yeah.
No, people love cooking with Brussels sprouts.
You know,
I'm trying to think of sunchokes. Those are pretty impossible.
Ooh, I like sunchokes. How about if you take a little Brussels sprouts, onion powder, grape, and cranberry, and you can make Brussels sprouts spaghetti? Lisa doesn't like Brussels sprouts, and I have been trying.
Oh, they are
endlessly.
They are cabbages that were at Three Mile Island.
Yeah.
No, they're delicious.
I
we
love
eat them all the time.
They're definitely a go in my house. Like,
total
go
doubt.
Throw those out right now. what did you say that you can't cook with anything with, Stacey?
Sunchokes.
Sunchokes. What are sunchokes? Are they like artichokes?
They're a Jerusalem artichoke.
Oh, that's what it is. Yeah, Jerusalem artichokes.
It's watery kind of thing.
So a little Fresno pepper, a little sunchoke, some chive and onion. You've got sunchoke casserole.
Sunchoke tostada.
Oh, that's weird.
Sunchoke pozole. Ooh. Add a little chicken, egg yolk, egg, onion, Fresno pepper, goat cheese, chive, salt, milk, and buttermilk, and you got a sunchoke casserole.
How do they get the picture?
Somebody must have made it.
Yeah.
Bon Appetit. I mean, IBM probably paid Bon Appetit a lot of money to run some of these through their test kitchen.
But it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
I love this. This is a great page. IBMChefWatson.com. Thank you, chat room, for coming up with this. They call it cognitive cooking. Let's get cooking. Wow. Mm-hmm. You can also choose a dish or pick a style. It's an anniversary. Let's have the computer cook. Tomatoes, strawberry, coriander, and sweet paprika. Mm-mm-mm. Happy anniversary, tomato bread. Our happy anniversary, tomato pasta salad. How about, honey, I made you an anniversary tomato sandwich with egg, champagne vinegar, green peas, tomato, strawberry, pita, kosher salt, soy sauce, hot sauce, collard greens, coriander seeds, sweet paprika, and a ground clove for flavor. Okay, maybe not.
What's his name? Who's the Washington Post columnist who said that if Trump became the nominee, he would eat his column?
Yeah.
Did you see all that? And so he had famous chefs come in.
Did he have Watson cook it up?
They cooked his column.
Oh, that's not fair.
It's kind of brilliant.
Yeah.
This is why I like working on the web.
Yeah.
Well, here's one. The Russian River every year has a slug festival trying to turn a bad into a good.
That's right up the they're right up the road from us.
What about slugs?
Slugs are not on the list. Sorry. You can't cook slugs.
You could try snails. That's an actual food.
I had to be a judge at the slug festival. There was a slugaroni, the Russian River treat. I gotta say, I gagged at some of them.
It's horrible.
We have a spam festival in Austin, but I prefer that to slugs.
So the trick with snails, if you want to turn snails into escargot, is, and we used to do this, you got to get a big barrel of cornmeal. And you put the snail in the cornmeal, and it eats its way out, and it gets rid of all the slime.
The snails eat their way out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, we got to talk about Nest, don't we?
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Ron. Thank you, Ron. So Tony Fadell leaving the Nest, and I loved the story. Let me see if I can find this story. This is Ron Amadio. I love his stuff. After Nest was acquired, and also love your illustration, Ron. After Nest was acquired by Google, they were offered unlimited funds and basically told, it doesn't matter if you have anything, make anything. An unlimited budget, no results, quadrupled its employees. It sounds like a mess. Was this all Tony Fadell's fault?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's from the Apple school of thinking. Like, he used to work at Apple, so he wanted to make himself the center of everything at the company. So it's kind of hard to blame anybody other than him. And I feel like it definitely went down like a firing because they announced he was leaving on like a Friday afternoon, which...
He said, I've been thinking about this since last year.
Sure.
The Verge reported that he actually told them in December. I'm not saying that that's what happened.
By the way, I'm thinking of having a heart attack in December. I'm thinking, just write this all down, of firing myself in December. And then when it happens, see, you can just say, I told you in May, June.
Well, so... The Verge story actually talked about, and it ties to what Ron's story did, which was he came on as this visionary guy, and he thought he was going to have like runway.
Yeah.
And now with the Alphabet rejiggering last year, he suddenly was like going to be held accountable for sales and product deliveries and less vision. So no wonder I can see how someone like Tony Fadell would leave.
Yeah.
That's no fun.
Well, I feel like Nest was the kind of inspiration for Alphabet, where he ran his own company just inside Google, and they kind of came up with the Alphabet thing later.
Yes, but remember,
I feel like this was the first Alphabet company.
Part of it, so it was kind of a double-edged sword, or maybe a carrot and a stick, because partly they wanted to give CEOs more control over their company and be able to say to somebody, oh, no, you're not just an employee at Google, you're the CEO of Nest. But at the same time, because of accounting reporting, their results would be public. So there was some accountability as well. So, yeah, you're going to get more autonomy, but also we're going to pay more attention to how you're doing. And you did feel like the heat was being turned up on Nest, like that Larry and the others are kind of starting to look over there and saying, I don't like what's going on over there.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, they had they had like a 4x increase in their employees, and they already had the smoke detector and the thermostat before they joined Google. And under Google, all they did is buy Dropcam and like rebrand it. And when you're Alphabet, you've got to say like, hey, you need to deliver more than just these tiny little minor updates. And they couldn't. And there's all sorts of stories about the stuff that they were working on that just was never good enough to see release, or that they never wanted to release. And they just sucked up a ton of resources and sat there and spun their wheels. And it seems like he got fired.
So you want a devil's advocate perspective?
Sure.
I think they did a lot of things. And if you look at it as a long-term vision, works with Nest took a lot of resources. And they were trying, they did not succeed utterly with that, but that was a really good program for pushing interoperability in the smart home on the Nest platform. So I would say that, I mean, they went from nothing to more than 80 partners. So, and that was all individual efforts. And then the other thing is they created the Thread protocol. Again, these are not things that you can sell. So if you think of Nest as a hardware company, you're like, oh, you guys, you're sucking wind. If you think of them as pushing forth a vision for the connected home, they were actually doing that. It's just you can't monetize that, which is a big problem.
It feels like
I think that's true, Stacey. The other question I think that the stories point out is, what have they done for you lately?
Right. I feel like at some point Google soured on Nest. Mm-hmm. Like they were high on Nest. They were excited. They gave them $500 million to buy Dropcam.
The Dropcam founder left with a big fit.
Yeah. And well, at some
Google
point, Google
made
soured.
Them buy Dropcam. Google made them buy Dropcam.
Oh, that's interesting.
They had started that acquisition before they bought Nest.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sure.
Well, they gave them Dropcam.
Yes. They
but
gave
you can
them-
see the writing on the wall when Rich Osterloh, who came to Google from Motorola, then left and went to Lenovo, but came back to Google. To Google, by the way, not to Alphabet or Nest, to Google, and was put in charge of hardware. Mm-hmm. That maybe the original plan was Nest is going to be our hardware home division, and then maybe not. Like there was a flip at some point.
I
love this paragraph from Ron's article. He says, in 2015, Nest posted job listings for its Nest audio team, the team would be responsible for, quote, developing an audio roadmap for Nest products, end quote. Industry observers suspected the audio team was building a smart Bluetooth speaker, but Google beat Nest to the punch with Google Home. According to the report from The Information, when Nest found out about Google Home, it asked to work on the project with Google. Nest's request was turned down.
Corporate politics.
Yeah. Somebody soured on him. I'm sure that Tony Fadell's personality didn't help.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's
kind of... I think it's clear Google was staying away from smart home stuff, and now they're not.
Right.
Which I think definitely means Nest, they felt like Nest was some kind of failure, and they just needed to go off and do their own thing.
Nest had something called Project Flintstone that they had been working on for 3 years. It had been killed or changed so many times, you report that one former employee called it Tombstone. Flintstone was a home security system, and you say Flintstone seems like another case of Nest being too slow for Google. Google's on-hub router performs some of the functions that Nest's Flintstone was at one time meant to perform. In other words, Google once again looked over the wall, looked over the transom, and said, "You know, let's do it ourselves. These guys are never going to finish."
Yeah, that's the thing about the Works with Nest program is it's like, why is my thermostat the hub right, of my right. household? Like,
it's the last yeah. place.
It doesn't seem like it's a cohesive vision that they tried to build. They're just like, well, this is what we have, so let's build it into the thermostat. When really it should be in some kind of a box that's kind of separate from everything, and that's what Flintstone sounded like it was going to be. But it just hasn't happened yet.
That's actually a big contentious point in the smart home, is where that stuff should live. And there's a huge number of people who are like, screw the hub. You know, this stuff shouldn't live there. Samsung's putting it in televisions because they're like, it's a device that people already have. You don't want to buy another thing. Yeah. That's why they threw it into Nest. And the idea with their Weave protocol, the Nest Weave, not the Google Weave, which does a lot of the same things, but is different because they're not friends, was that it wouldn't eventually live in just the Nest. It would, or the thermostat, it would live in everything.
It's a mesh. It's a mesh protocol.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what happened is the smart home looked really awesome for a little while, and people were like, yes, yes, go, go. And then they're like, oh, whoa, this is confusing. Nothing's interoperable.
Do we lose her?
No, we didn't lose her. She just stopped for some reason. Okay.
You weren't interoperable there for a moment.
I wasn't. So this is the first day when it's really hot. And when it gets really hot, the beginning of every season, summer, I have to call Time Warner because my cable, like the frequencies get messed up.
It's too hot, man.
Wow.
Really weird. I know. They have to come out to the box and fix it there. It's
how telling was it when Brad Fitzpatrick, who created LiveJournal and is now at Google, created a video in February saying, do not buy a smoke alarm. They false alarm and are unhushable pieces of crap. But, I mean, this is not a good ad from somebody who ostensibly works under the same corporate umbrella. Now, admittedly, Brad Fitzpatrick probably gets to do whatever he wants at Google, but I think that's a sign that Google had soured.
Yeah.
Yeah, the hate internally from Googlers was pretty crazy. You can see some of the pictures down there that they made and the YouTube video. That was probably a big part of it. The employees kind of like rised up and started to complain about the company.
They put these on internal message boards at Google.
Yeah.
Nest, Alphabet, Goodwill. It's a wedge.
In terms of what you build a hub into, though, I don't really want it built into anything at this point because smart homes are so kind of new and flaky that I just want to be able to take the hub and throw it in the trash when something better comes out. Like, I don't want to build into my television because I'm going to keep the TV for years and years, where the smart home stuff knows.
Most people don't want to deal with that. I mean, like, I'm that way too. I've got four hubs because why not? But most people are like,
I'm not sure.
They don't want a hub.
They don't want to. I think most people are content with standalone devices that have their own apps. You know, my sprinkler has its own app. My lights, the outdoor lights have their own app. My doorbell has its own app. My Hue lights have their own app. And that's easier, I think, for most normal people than getting a hub working with a single app.
Yes, it totally is. Although, if you want to tell me what you've got, I can totally recommend hubs and things that work.
I have the latest smart things, and I just never set it all up. No, really? What do you like?
Smart things. It's open and awesome, but it's, like, not as reliable.
Well, that's my point exactly, which is you spend all this energy getting everything working, and it's a house of cards.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it really is.
And so I agree with you, Ron. I mean, I'm gonna wait, and maybe this will all shake out. Maybe it won't, but at least I can still sell when my doorbell rings and I can turn off my sprinkler. And I'm just going to leave it at that. I don't mind. That's why I have 200 apps on here.
So I think the question is next is what does Nest do next now that they have a new CEO? Yeah. The CEO, I'm not going to get his name off the top of my head. It's like
Marwan
Fuzzy Bear? What?
He used to work at Google. He was in charge of, when they had Motorola, he was in charge of the Motorola Home division.
Marwan
Fawaz.
Fawaz,
yeah.
And all he really did with the home division was ship it out the door. He sold it for like some billion dollars to Aris, like 6 months after he took it over. So
nice job.
In maybe the that's article,
he's like a spin. He's a spinoff guy, right? He's a sell. He's a M&A guy.
Yeah, in the article, I had kind of speculated that he was like the Grim Reaper at Google, where he just kind of shows up and pounces for sales time. But during the show, an article came out at The Verge, I think it was, where they found Nest released like an internal memo that said, "We're not going to sell the company. We're totally going to get all those products that we were working on. We're totally going to make those and like release those as real products." And they're very much at like stay the course right now. Which is insane to me. Like, I can't imagine Nest being any good.
If I were Fawaz, I would tell the employees that until we got the sale done.
So, go
ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I saw your story and I started thinking about Nest and what it has to offer. And because it has such rigorous terms of service and privacy kind of standards, if it were sold as a standalone company, what you're selling is the millions of Nest customers with a device that don't pay a subscription. So you're getting the data. You're going to have to support this device for like 10 years. So you're buying an obligation basically to support this in the cloud. And it's unclear if you can change the TOS or not. I mean, you could always try it, but the FTC is kind of like keeping an eye on stuff like that. And I guarantee they would look at this. So then what is the business value of Nest?
And well, I'm looking at Nest like what is left for Alphabet to use. And like when you set up a company where you are the Steve Jobs in this company, where every minor decision runs through you and then you leave, like what is left of that company for Alphabet to salvage? And we've already heard about employee exoduses there and people like crying in the bathrooms and how it's a bad place to work. I can't imagine many of the good people still hung around. So I don't know what Google thinks they're going to salvage from Nest.
Wow.
They could just, I think there's a huge opportunity to sell these devices. I think it's probably going to be more interesting to sell them through different channels, so not direct to consumers, because most people have purchased a Nest if they're going to purchase it, I feel like, and the smart home is totally stagnated. So I would look for him to do deals with Comcast, with AT&T, with anybody who's doing those kind of sales to customers, like the mainstream America. And then also, you know, Nest did some deals with ADT. It was like a promotional deal. You got ADT Pulse, you got a Nest along with it. ADT Pulse is their security plus home automation product. And the deals with insurance companies. And this guy he's got the experience to do that kind of thing and ship.
ADT board, right?
He was. And he actually was on the technical advisory board when they started doing their smart home efforts. So he's aware of this space. So I tried to talk to him. They were like, nope, not going to talk to you, Stacey. So we'll see. I'm hopeful because I think it's it's a strategy shift. And I'm not sure if in the long term Alphabet's going to want this, but I don't think they're going to be ready to let it go just yet. Because it's still a space that is going to do something. It will be useful. It's just, we're not sure how yet.
I think the most valuable part of Nest is the devices that they have made and the install base that they do have. But that's all in the past. I think
it's the
future
data.
Of Nest. The future of Nest is the least valuable part. Like, I don't think there's a serious company there in place that can do great things in the future anymore. I think all that kind of got dismantled or quit or left.
What do they pay for it?
$3.2 billion.
Yeah.
Not plus another half a billion or so.
Not as bad as Motorola.
True. And at the time, Nest was selling about 40,000 thermostats a month.
Yeah. What are they selling now? Has it gone down?
They will not tell you.
Yeah.
No, they said 50% year over year, every year. So if you know what year they were selling that amount, you can do some math, right? When was that?
Yeah. They bought them in January 2014. Did they announce the deal then? Or did they? Let me find the 40,000 number because.
Well, anyway, if they're growing 50% every year, that's good. That's what they told you, Ron, after your article got published.
Yeah. My PR letter. But supposedly
I'll have you know, we're growing 50% a year.
Ecopy's growing 100% a year.
You know who else is growing 50% a year? Axl Rose.
Wow. He's real upset about it.
In the last 2 weeks, Axl Rose has filed 11 DMCA takedown requests to Google saying, I want those pictures of me from this 2010 Winnipeg concert where I'm really fat and it's become a meme. I want them taken down. That's going to work.
Yeah. Yeah, that always works. That's going to work.
Yeah. Okay. This is a website, the best fat Axl Rose memes on the internet. I think actually he should probably contact Tumblr. Get this taken down.
Yeah.
Was it a DMCA takedown?
It was like, a DMCA. I own those pictures of the fat Axl Rose.
He needs to move to Europe and do a right to be forgotten.
Yeah, right to be.
But I mean, is his claim that he owns the pictures because he's in them? Like, that's not how it works.
Yeah, I know. I know. Yeah.
Were they taken by his concert photographer or something? And yeah. Someone got, I mean, because Beyonce tried that.
Did that work? How'd that work for Beyonce?
Well, actually, I think she may have, like, I think she banned photographers that weren't certified or something from her concert.
Yeah, like that's what she ended up doing, right? That's dumb.
You know, Beyonce is... She can do no wrong. In fact, I didn't say that. Everyone, I did not say
anything
bad. She's
the queen bee. Are you in the, what do they call it? The beehive?
The beehive?
The beehive?
Beehive. I think it's beehive. I am not.
You're not in the beehive?
They're going to be mad at me.
I'm in the beehive.
I love Beyonce.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. No. When we went to the Super Bowl, we saw Beyonce. When you sat in your seats, this was in New Orleans about 3 or 4 years ago when the Niners were there. They had a little package. You know, you always get a little something to hold up or show. And they were LED finger rings. And the instructions said, when Beyonce sings, put a ring on it, you all have to go, no, 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 with your finger ring.
Great.
I think Taylor Swift does that at her concert. She has everybody gets synchronized lights.
Yeah.
Light sticks.
Yeah, it's cool, I guess. Hey, it would have been more cool if we'd won the game.
Yeah.
Anything else? I'm just looking here. I don't see anything really worth. Anyway, we've had a good show. Let's end on a high note. The fat Axl Rose meme.
I was going to say Beyonce.
This is the high note. We're going to come back after this break and get your number, Jeff, if you've still got one.
We didn't use it up. I got one there.
And any tips or recommendations? Our guest, Ron Amadio from Ars Technica, and our regular, I'm pleased to say, co-host Stacey Higginbotham from Stacey on IoT have for us. But first, a word from Texture. I know I still love magazines. I know journalism's in trouble, but there's still great long-form journalism being done in some of the best magazines in the world. Every week, there's something in The New Yorker I want to read. Every month, there's something in Rolling Stone or Vanity Fair or, you know, Wired that I want to read. But if I were to subscribe to all those magazines, my coffee table would break under the load. And I'm certainly not going to buy individual editions on the newsstand. Then I'd be hundreds of dollars a month. That's why Texture is so cool. It's like Netflix, but for magazines. Instead of binge watching, you can binge read. And this is what you need for your summer, man. Take all the magazines that you love on your iPad or your phone or your Android tablet. Read them. It's every page. It's in the newsstand edition, plus back issues, plus bonus features you can't get on print, like videos. National Geographic's in there, Interview Magazine, Men's Health, and stuff maybe you wouldn't subscribe to. Like, I don't know. I like every once in a while, I like to flip through Vogue or Sports Illustrated or Esquire. There's something in there I want to read. It's all there. The world's most popular magazines. And if you don't know what to read, their editors have top stories and new and noteworthy sections, plus curated sections with specific topics so you can dive deep into interviews and stories in an area that you're interested in. And sometimes, you know, you want to know, so what's happening with Beyonce? How's that Jay-Z thing working out? You can read your People magazine or your Entertainment Weekly or, you know, it's all in there. I love it. Texture.com/twig. You try it free. Really get a sense of it. Texture.com/twig. You'll gain immediate entry to all the top magazines, including back issues, bonus video content, and it's free right now. for a limited time at Texture, T-E-X-T, like text, URE.com/twig. They've reimagined the magazine experience, and I think they're keeping magazines alive. I love it. I really love it. I'm glad they are, too. Jeff Jarvis, your number of the week.
Before I start, I want to just want to mention one thing that I mentioned earlier briefly, but I went to, I use a three. I'll make it a three.
Three's good. Love three.
I went to a Axel Springer session summit on distributed content with 25 publishers, then Newsgeist with 150 people in the business, then 100 people at a Google Play event. And I wrote a piece on Medium about this just before the show. I dashed it out.
Really? I would have never, man, you're good because this is a nice piece. I would never have thought you just dashed
it. The airplane helped.
Yes.
Though I slept on part.
Getting Google and publishers to share love and data.
So just the quick thing here is that I found that publishers have been saying, we want data. Google, give us data. And Google says, well, you don't know what you want, and you won't know what to do with it. So I went to these conferences saying, we've got to get more specific about what our desires and goals are. And by God, it kind of worked. People had ideas about how, for example, Google could help improve the recommendations we make to our readers, maybe eliminating something called Taboola in our brain. I don't know. Also, if Google knew that you were a subscriber to the New York Times when you search on a topic, shouldn't New York Times topic content come up because you subscribe and pay for it? Maybe to protect privacy, we need to have a framework to categorize users and content in ways that Google could share with us, Facebook, publishers could share with each other. So the only point is that I have a constant quest for peace in the kingdom and trying to bring publishers and platforms together to do things rather than just fighting and presuming evil of the other or stupidity of the other, as the case may be. And it was a heartwarming, productive week, I think. We'll see. I'm an optimist, but I think it was a week of jet lag well spent. So good. I just wanted to kind of plug Google and Springer and all the publishers and editors who came, all in good faith and a lot of good discussion and good efforts. And so that's it.
I saw that picture of you and Richard Gingras.
Yeah, it was funny. Yeah. Somebody wanted, because we're assumed to be double gangers.
Yeah. Well, you both got the beard and the black, and I think so. He's still in charge of Google News and promoting AMP and.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, listening to publishers. Was he the listener in chief?
Yeah, for Newsgeist, he's kind of the MC.
Yeah,
Newsgeist is an unconference, so you end up with like 60 different sessions on a lot of fascinating kind of topics. It's great. Yeah,
I love that stuff. Stacey, what are you liking these days?
Okay, I have to first correct myself from last week when I said that Kevin worked for...
Kevin Toefel.
Kevin Toefel worked for the Chromecast team. That was wrong. I was all excited.
Half right.
Chromecast. I was blinded by the Chrome. he works for the Chrome at work and the Android at work teams. Ah. So keep that in mind, y'all. And here is my recommendation. This is only... Well, it's not only for parents. But with summer coming up, this is a game.
Ooh.
You can play with your kids.
I want a game. Good.
It's a
Forbidden Island.
And okay, y'all, this is like the most complicated game you will ever encounter.
Oh, I'm buying it right now.
But it's awesome. It's a
I love board games.
It's a collaborative play game. So you play all together as a team, and your goal is to catch all of those four little pieces before your island sinks. And there's limitations on how you can play.
I like it that it's a cooperative game. That's cool.
My daughter hates playing things that are super competitive.
Right.
So she loves this game. And it's, like I said, it's complex it's complex to learn. It's not actually that complicated.
Your daughter's a little young for this. Age 10 and up.
She's going to be 10 in August.
Oh, I guess that's close enough. 2010 Mensa Favorite Brainy Games winner.
So it's fun. It's a strategy game. So I totally recommend it for if you're bored this summer and you want to hang out with your kids.
Have you ever played The Resistance?
Let's see.
Oh, man.
No, I haven't.
This is not for your kid. This is for 13
just
and up. I think teenagers love this because it's really, some people are spies. Some people are resistance. It's kind of Werewolf Hunger Games feel to it. It's really good. It's really fun. And there's a lot of strategy.
I like it.
It's challenging. Yeah.
It's a kind of a, I like, you know what? Board games, summertime and board games. They go
together. It's 100 degrees here, so I'm not going outside.
Jeez Louise. Wow. Ron Amadio, what are you doing these days? What are you excited about?
I was going to recommend a YouTube channel to everybody. It's called Captain Christian, and it's a, don't worry about the name. It's like a video essay kind of thing on like geek culture. So a lot of it has to do with superheroes lately for some reason. But there's one about like the X-Men where they're, the movies are like ashamed of the X-Men costumes and, and how important color kind of is to the design of the X-Men and how in the movies, everybody just wears black leather and it's super lame. But it's a, the videos are all like incredibly well done and well edited and narrated and everything. And the channel only has like 80,000 subscriptions.
Well, it's
or something.
Pretty new, right? I mean, it's only like 2 months old.
Right. Yeah. It started about 2 months ago, but the content is excellent and definitely something I would recommend people subscribe to if they're into kind of fun little dissertations on whatever the geeky topic of the month is.
Captain Christian with K's.
Yes.
And, so this is nerd culture, baby. Nerd culture. Very nice.
But yeah, in terms of tech stuff, next week we've got, tomorrow we've got the Lenovo Tech World. Which
and you said the Moto Z. Is that going to be like a Moto X, like plus two? Or?
It's the new Motorola flagship.
Yeah.
That's at least what the rumor mill says. Regardless of what the name turns out to be, who cares? It's just going to be this really weird thing that has like modules again, like the G5. like there's a set of like pogo pins on the back where you can clip stuff into it.
Is the G5 even out yet?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's out. People have it?
Somewhere here.
Okay.
This.
All right.
See, any phone you ask is within arm's reach. what else? There's something else going on that I was going to. I don't remember. But there's going to be Project Tango at Tech World, and that's all I can think of.
I guess if I think about it, they couldn't really follow the Moto X with the Moto Y. It'd be like Moto
Well,
y.
They've done Moto X's every year. Well, see, this year right. Lenovo is. Really taking over Motorola and ruining them. So it's going to be some fun.
Going to be fun. Going to be a good time. All right, kids. What fun this was. Always a pleasure. And we got some good stuff going here. Jeff Jarvis from the City University of New York and BuzzMachine.com, his blog. And don't forget his books, Geek Sparing News, What Would Google Do?, Public Parts, Gutenberg the Geek. Yes, those are all real titles. I'm not making those up. And .nyc, have you got a solid day for that yet, or are you still trying it out?
No, we're still, I think we took your good advice and Lisa's good advice, and what we're trying to do is kind of get our act together and figure out what it is first.
And so then do it every day.
Not every day.
Every week. You're traveling a lot soon, right?
I think I'm through the worst of it.
Oh, good.
I think.
Oh, good. So we'll see you next week here. All right.
Yeah. Next week. No, next week. You sent the whole calendar.
Yes.
But you got the calendar.
It's complicated.
Yeah, I won't bore the audience with that now.
It's a complicated relationship. Thank you, Jeff. Thanks to Stacey Higginbotham. Don't forget her podcast with Kevin Toefel of Google Chrome at Work and Android at Work. And she's at StacyOnIoT.com, and you'll find the podcast there and all her IoT work. It's great to see you again.
Thanks
Stay
for
cool in this 100-degree weather.
Oh, that's coming. It's not there yet.
Oh. Do you guys have a pool or something?
No, we have a postage stamp that's filled with cacti. It's much better than a pool. It requires no maintenance.
It's climate appropriate. All right. Well, that would be a go or a whoa. I think a whoa for sure. I'm not swimming in that.
Yeah.
Ron Amadio, you'll find his great work, and we quote it all the time, Ron. You've really become a go-to columnist at ArsTechnica.com. In fact, Ron makes regular appearances also on All About Android. Thank you all for being here. We do this show every Wednesday right before TNT, right after Windows Weekly. Usually about 1:30 to p.m., that may be 4:30 Eastern time, 20:30 UTC, right about that time. I hope you'll join us for the live show. Join us in studio as some very nice people did Maybe they just wanted to get out of the heat. I don't know. Email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. If you can't watch live, twit.tv/twig is the website. But, of course, you can subscribe on every possible platform. Don't miss a week. It's good every week. We'll see you right back here next Wednesday on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.